It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around.
This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Aid in attendance is a benefit designed to help pay for the consistent, ongoing medical expenses that you incur when mom or dad get to a point where they need medication management or someone to help them get dressed. Basically, when we need an aide or a caregiver to give them assistance on a daily basis with the things that you and I take for granted, that's what the VA is trying to help pay for with this benefit.
Eric Jorgensen from the American Association for Wartime Veterans discusses the rules to get veterans aid and attendance available to wartime veterans and their surviving spouses, and the huge difference this little-known and valuable benefit can make. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how fake debt collectors got permanently barred from debt collection and may have to surrender more than $5 million. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 185, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. California companies working with bogus debt collectors in India agreed to settle Federal Trade Commission or FTC charges they deceived and threatened consumers into paying debts that were not owed or that the companies were not authorized to collect. The case against Via Park, Varang K. Thacker, American Credit Crunchers LLC, and EB's LLC is part of the FTC's crackdown on scams that target consumers in financial distress. The settlement order bans the defendants from debt collection and prohibits them from misrepresenting that they are affiliated with the government or a nonprofit group. As part of the settlement, the defendants will turn over nearly all of their assets, an estimated $170,000, to be used for consumer refunds. The order also includes a $5.4 million judgment, which is equivalent to the full amount of injury. The monetary judgment will be partially suspended due to the defendant's inability to pay. But if it is determined that the financial information they gave the FTC was untruthful, the remaining amount of the judgment will become due. The companies would contact consumers who previously had received or inquired about online payday loans. Often pretending to be law enforcement or other governmental authorities, the callers would falsely threaten to immediately arrest and jail consumers if they did not agree to make a payment on a supposedly delinquent payday loan. Saying they represented the local police department, the Federal Department of Crime and Prevention, or simply a federal investigator, the callers typically demanded more than $300 and sometimes as much as $2,000. At other times, the callers claimed to be filing a large lawsuit against the consumer or threatened to have the consumer fired from his or her job. But the consumers did not owe money to defendants, either because the payday loan debts did not exist or the defendants had no authority to collect them because they were owed to someone else. Consumers received millions of collection calls from India, and in a two-year period, the operation took in more than $5 million from victims. The harassed and threatened consumers often paid the alleged debts out of fear of being arrested or sued. For more information about how to handle callers who claim to be debt collectors, see Who's Calling? That Debt Collector Could Be a Fake, available at www.ftc.gov. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Umbarger versus Virginia Employment Commission. Kathy Umbarger, the only female employee with Glenn Roberts Tire and Recapping, confronted her supervisor with allegations of sexual discrimination after he offered all of the male employees raises. The employer refused to give Ms. Umbarger a raise, and she resigned. She was denied unemployment compensation due to a voluntary quit without good cause. The Wise County Circuit Court agreed, but the Court of Appeals reversed. The appeals court said Ms. Umbarger reasonably believed herself to be a victim of sexual discrimination and that, as a matter of law, she had exhausted all of her alternatives when she confronted the supervisor and he failed to respond. Ms. Umbarger was not required to seek relief from the out-of-state corporate parent, which was uninvolved in the management, or from other agencies or organizations, in order to show good cause for quitting. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Umbarger versus Virginia Employment Commission is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
We're here in the west end of Henrico County. We're speaking with Eric Jorgensen. He is a financial planner and a professional member of the American Association for Wartime Veterans, and we are going to be speaking in particular about the Veterans Administration Aid and Attendance Improved Pension. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Would you tell our listening audience, first of all, what is the American Association for Wartime Veterans?
It is a private, nonprofit organization. The goal is to give the veterans and their families an education on a benefit called aid and attendance. If they would like some assistance from us, we will actually help them go get the benefit, and we do not charge a fee for our services.
Now, the association seems to be focused pretty much on the Veterans Administration Aid and Attendance Improved Pension, otherwise we call it aid and attendance. What is this benefit exactly?
Aid and attendance is a benefit designed to help pay for the consistent ongoing medical expenses that you incur when mom or dad get to a point where they need medication management or someone to help them get dressed. Basically, when we need an aide or a caregiver to give them assistance on a daily basis with the things that you and I take for granted, that's what the VA is trying to help pay for with this benefit.
So this would apply to veterans and I guess possibly spouses and dependents who perhaps need home health care or assisted living or nursing home care or things like that?
That's exactly right. It's not just for the veterans, the surviving spouses, or in a case where we have a veteran that's married, it can be just for the spouse even if the veteran is not eligible yet. But it's going to be based on the veteran's service to our country during a period of war.
Now, I understand there are four general rules that govern who is eligible for this program. Would you list those rules, and then we'll go through them one by one?
There are four criteria. The first one, of course, is military service. The second is medical. Third is income. And the fourth are assets. So if we wanted to take them one by one, the first one is military service.
What do we mean by military service?
The veteran needed to be active during a period of war. So that's right. If they were not active during a period of war, or if they were only in the reserves, that does not qualify. The veteran needed to be active for at least 90 consecutive days during a period of war. They did not, however, need to be in country. So if you were in San Diego or if you were stationed in Germany, as long as you were active during a period of war, you can qualify for this benefit.
And by a period of war, obviously World War II would count, the Korean War would count. What other wars would count as, quote, wartime service?
The only ones that would count, just like you mentioned, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and then the entire time we were in the Gulf. But situations such as Grenada, Panama, those would not qualify.
Does the veteran have to have been discharged from military service under any particular type of discharge?
Yes, they do. The VA is pretty specific about this. As long as it's anything other than a dishonorable discharge, you can qualify. So obviously the honorable discharge is the main thing that they're looking for, but the benefit is available to people that have even seen conditions other than honorable. The benefit is still available.
And is there any minimum age that the veteran needs to be in order to qualify for this benefit?
I think minimum age might be misleading. What you usually hear is the age of 65. If you're under the age of 65, you can still qualify, but the rules are different. Over the age of 65 is really where most people will fall into this benefit. If you're under the age of 65, usually there's some disability related to it, so the rules are different.
Now, you said, secondly, there's a medical eligibility criterion. What does that mean?
As I mentioned before, the benefit was designed to help pay for the consistent ongoing medical benefits for the veteran or for the spouse. What we're looking to do is when mom and dad might need some assistance, we need help with our medications because maybe there's some dementia or some Alzheimer's, we have to pay an aide or a caregiver to manage their medication for them. This is what the VA is trying to help pay for. They call them an activity of daily living. So medication management would qualify. If mom or dad might be a fall risk in the shower, you could say that they need shower assistance. But these activities of daily living are what the VA is trying to help pay for. So what we need is a note from the doctor. And the VA, of course, has their own form for this. But the doctor is the one that's going to prescribe mom or dad needs this assistance. And that's what makes us eligible for this benefit.
And these activities of daily living, I assume that can also be things like dressing or feeding or things of that nature. Is there any specific number of activities of daily living that the person needs assistance with?
For the most part, the answer is going to be one. As long as they need assistance with at least one activity of daily living, you can qualify. And as I mentioned, the doctor is the one that's going to state that the veteran or the spouse needs that assistance. But yes, dressing counts as an activity of daily living. Feeding is one that is misunderstood. It does not mean that they need assistance cooking the meals. Generally speaking, this means that they have difficulty getting the food from the plate to their mouths. If you are in need of, say, assistance with two activities of daily living, the benefit does not change.
And the third criterion you mentioned was income. And I gather that it's not an income limit so much as where their income has to go to.
Right. There's two general rules for this. The one that you might see on the VA's website, or if you do a Google search, you might see a dollar figure closer to $12,000 or $13,000. That is, if your income is below that, you tend to qualify regardless of the medical expenses. But for most people, what it's going to be is they're going to compare your income to your medical expenses. So if we get to the point where we're spending more on our medical expenses than we're bringing in each month, we qualify. So it's going to be important to learn what counts as a medical expense.
So what does, in fact, count as a medical expense?
When you submit your application for the first time, they generally only count the aide that is offering that assistance or the home that you live in. If we're in an assisted living or a nursing home, the entire cost of your rent there can act as a medical expense. If we're paying premiums for health insurance, that would count as a medical expense. If we have long-term insurance premiums, that would count. What does not count are prescriptions, doctor copays, other medical supplies tend to not count when you submit your application. The VA is trying to find those consistent ongoing medical expenses, and prescriptions tend to change over time. Doctor copays are not always consistent, and that's why they don't count.
So it sounds as if the medical expenses that count more or less have something to do with the activities of daily living that the veteran needs assistance with?
That's exactly right. What the assistance comes down to, let's take the case of medication management, as we mentioned. If you have a parent with some sort of dementia or Alzheimer's and they're receiving that medication management, it's a condition that's not going to go away. We're expecting them to need this assistance probably for the rest of their lives, which would be different from, say, mom falls in the shower and breaks a hip, goes through several months of rehab. That's not something the VA is trying to help with, is the broken hip, because it's something that you go through and you get rehab and then you're back to normal, hopefully. The VA is looking for those consistent ongoing expenses, maybe like Alzheimer's, or I need help getting dressed because my shoulder doesn't work the way it used to, or I don't bend as well as I used to, and that's not likely to change over time.
And then the fourth and final criterion, as I understand, and it may be the most confusing and possibly most misunderstood of them, is the asset criterion. What does that mean?
Anytime you see a benefit such as this, there's going to be asset criteria. They don't want the benefit to go out to people that certainly have means to pay for it themselves. But there's two parts to this. The first part is, if you are under the age of 85, the VA is going to say you can have somewhere between $40,000 and $80,000 in your name. You're also allowed to have a principal residence, your house. But that $40,000 to $80,000 number I mentioned, we don't actually know what that number is. There's no formula that the VA has set up. So if your application went to three different people at the VA, you'd get three different numbers on what you're allowed to have. It is based on life expectancy. It's based on how fast we're spending through our assets. But it's subjective. And that's why, since we don't know what that exact number is, we recommend you submit your application with $40,000 or less. You'd hate to put it in at $48,000 or $52,000 and get declined when $40,000 would have worked. The other part of this is, when you get over the age of 85, the amount of assets you can have in your name starts to decrease. Because remember, I said part of this was based on life expectancy. So by the time you get to be about age 95, we recommend you have about $5,000 or less in your name. Now, can you get approved if the amount is over that? You can, but it's guesswork at that point. We'd hate to put you in a position where you may or may not get approved.
And what can a veteran do if the veteran substantially exceeds those asset figures that you mentioned, whether it's the $5,000, the $40,000, the $80,000? Is there some way to nevertheless get approved?
You can. The benefit was designed, I think, correctly to allow the veteran and their spouse, if they are overqualified, their income is too high or their assets are too high, the VA will allow you to shelter those assets. And in my opinion, they do it on purpose. I believe that what they're trying to do is they'll say, if mom and dad have, say, $250,000, but they're spending $5,000 a month at assisted living, or if they're both there, maybe they're spending somewhere between $7,000 and $10,000 a month, you can see that that money would be dwindled very quickly. This benefit is only designed to assist. It's not designed to fix the problem. So when the veteran receives this benefit, if we've sheltered the assets, the goal is they will receive the benefit and still be liquidating their assets. They will just be liquidating them much slower. The goal, as I mentioned, is to keep mom and dad out of a nursing home. If we can get them to live comfortably in their own home or an assisted living community without running out of money, that's what the VA is trying to do, and that's why they allow you to shelter the assets.
And just in brief and general terms, what do we mean by sheltering the assets?
The quick version is, we don't want the assets to remain in mom and dad's name. There is no look back. I don't want to give financial planning advice over the radio. It's a case-by-case basis. Each person might shelter it differently. But it is important to know that sheltering is something that is legal. Hiding would be illegal. But sheltering is something that people have done in a number of ways and don't even realize they've done it. A simple example is, if you've ever contributed to an IRA or your 401k plan, that's considered a tax shelter. And that's the legal name for it, is a tax-sheltered annuity. So sheltering is perfectly legal. The nice thing about the VA and the way they've set this up is they don't have a look-back period. So if you've sheltered your assets today, you can submit your application the next day. It's important to keep in mind that if you do shelter the assets, you want to set them up in such a way that you can get access to them, because we're going to still need that money. We're going to still spend it down in almost every case. We're just going to spend it slower. And the goal is, if mom and dad only have enough money for, say, 4 years, maybe this benefit gets them to 6 or 7 years. It's trying to extend their wealth. It's not trying to preserve it. It's trying to keep them at a point where they don't run out of money, because these communities that you live in are private pay. And if we run out of money and you can't afford it, the communities will say, I'm sorry, we can't keep you.
So how does the veteran end up having the asset out of his or her name and yet have access to it?
Normally what you need is a strong family structure. Oftentimes when we get to the point where mom is at assisted living or dad is receiving that caregiver, a power of attorney has already been set up. So you tend to have a family member in most cases acting for the benefit of mom and dad already. So what we need, as long as we have something like that set up, we can keep that power structure, if you will, where maybe a son or daughter can act in mom or dad's best interest and handle those affairs for them. This does not necessarily mean that I want to put the money in their name. If the daughter has power of attorney, we want to make sure that she still retains control for the benefit of mom and dad.
How much is the benefit that we are talking about here for a veteran who would get the aid in attendance, let's say for this year, 2012?
If it's just the veteran, would receive $1,703 a month. Now, that's a tax-free benefit paid by the VA. The benefit gets paid to you, not to the community or not to the caregiver. So you have control of those funds. But keep in mind, they're designed to pay those medical expenses. In the case of a surviving spouse, which means the veteran has passed away and the spouse is now in need of this assistance, they can receive $1,094 a month. Again, it's a tax-free benefit, comes every month. If the veteran and spouse are married, the benefit can be as high as $2,019 a month.
And what is the process for applying for and getting this benefit? Can you lead us through that and give us some kind of time frame that veterans could expect?
Sure. When you put your paperwork together for the VA and you mail it off, what you're going to find is the VA works on a monthly basis, the 1st of November, the 1st of December. So what that means is if you mail your application off on the 25th of the month, it may or may not get there by the 1st. If it gets there by the 1st, that's your start date, is the 1st of that month. If we don't get it, your start date will be the 1st of the following month, and you'll have lost 1 month of the benefit. Once the VA has your application, it may take quite a while for this to be approved. Generally, what we're seeing is somewhere between 4 weeks and 9 months to be approved. I will say that the benefit is retroactive to when the application was received by the VA. So if you were to get a November 1st start date and you waited, say, 6 months to get approved, they will pay back the 6 months that you waited.
And finally, where can people get more information about the American Association for Wartime Veterans?
The first thing I would think of is there is a website. It's usawarvet.org, and that's our website, so you'll certainly be able to look into who we are and the benefit that's available. We have an 800 number that you can call. The main office for the American Association for Wartime Veterans is in Southeast Michigan. So if you call the 800 number, that's where you'll be directed. And then, of course, we have a local office here, which is in the West End.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Eric Jorgensen. He is a financial planner and a professional member of the American Association for Wartime Veterans. And we have been talking about the Veterans Administration Aid and Attendance Improved Pension. Thank you so much for being on the show, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 64.2, which deals with wills and descendants' estate. Under Code of Virginia Section 64.2-402, any person who advertises any direct or indirect offer to draw any will or have any will drawn is guilty of a Class 3 misdemeanor, except that this does not apply to attorneys, attorney partnerships, or attorney professional corporation as long as they advertise in accordance with court rules. LegalZoom.com, USLegalForms.com, and other internet legal forms providers specifically state that they are not a law firm or a substitute for an attorney or law firm. which seems to be a pretty clear admission they are committing Class 3 misdemeanor. From the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The history of Virginia's Constitution demonstrates the truth of Thomas Jefferson's statement that the earth always belongs to the living generation. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Dick Howard, Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, traces the evolution of Virginia's six constitutions. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.